Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, and I'm coming to you actually from College Station in Texas. That's where the big university is. And when I'm at the home of my wife's daughter and her husband, she's just given birth to a beautiful boy, Miles. So I'm celebrating that. And it's my fourth grandchild. So it's a wonderful time. So today we have also a joy because we've got a wonderful person, and we're going to look at one of the books that he's written in the Literary Portals to Prayer series. What it does, it matches 50 short passages from, in this case, the great 19th century novelist George Eliot, with passages from the Bible translated into modern English by theologian Eugene H. Peterson in his edition entitled The Message. You might be familiar with that particular translation of the Bible. And the compiler, as I said, is Darren Middleton. He's my guest today. Darren's been on the show many times. He's professor of religion at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, and directs TCU's Master of Liberal Arts program. He was born and raised in the Midlands of England and has published books in the area of theology and comparative literature, as well as religion and the arts. He joined me previously to discuss his editing of a series of essays on Shusaku Endo's novel Silence, which was recently made into a wonderful film, as some of you may have seen. And he's also the author of Endo's final novel, the compilation of essays around that called Deep River. An expert on Rastafarianism, he joined me for that show too. He's also written about novelist Graham Greene, Nikos Kazantzakis, and non-Western Christianity. So it's a great pleasure to welcome this polymath named Professor Darren Middleton to today's show. Welcome, Darren.
Thank you, Paul. It's wonderful to be here, and congratulations on being a grandfather again.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, just I was one about 2.5 months ago because my daughter gave birth to her third, and so I went from 2 to 4 just like that. So it's great. It's a great time of life to do that. Absolutely. You know, what made me excited was I hadn't read George Eliot for many years, you know, since I was in college, probably, actually. And doing some research for this inspired me, you know, to read more of her, go back to her, because her sensibility was great. It was wonderful, wasn't it? I was reading about Middlemarch, a great masterpiece, and they're saying it's probably the best book ever written in English, English literature. And that's high praise indeed for this 19th century woman. Because for those who aren't familiar, George Eliot is the nom de plume, the pseudonym for Mary Ann Evans, right? And she lived a pretty unconventional life, didn't she? She was deeply spiritual, but she was in a liaison with a married man. Or I guess he was estranged from his wife, but they were together for 30 some years, which was, you know, back in the Victorian era, that was quite radical. But it didn't seem to faze her, right? She was quite ugly, supposedly, but when people are around her for a while, they saw her as incredibly beautiful because of her spark, her intelligence, and people would fall in love with her. When did you first get into George Eliot, Darren?
Actually, I think I would owe my fondness for George Eliot to my wife, who was an English major at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, and then not far from where you are now. She was a master's student in English literature at the University of Texas at Austin. So I know that's a rival for where you are at the moment with Texas
That's
A&M,
right.
but Betsy, my wife, eventually kind of did a turn towards religion, but never really left literature behind. And she's a professor of American religious history these days. And she put me on to Eliot, and I started actually with Silas Marner, which was I would have to say the least intimidating of her books, because you pick up something like Middlemarch and you realize it's a bit like the same experience of when you pick up The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. You have a wonderful book on your hands, and it comes with such high praise, but the size or the weight of the thing just is intimidating. And so I set Middlemarch to one side and read Silas Marner, which is a beautiful tale of a man who's wrongly accused and who then sort of leaves the town and really sort of tries to find himself and the money that he accrues, and then an opium-addled woman leaves her child on his steps one winter, and he realizes that the gold of the young child's locks of hair are far more important to him as the years go by than the gold that he had tried to accrue. And so he finds something of himself, a new identity through his care and his love for this orphan child. And it was a beautiful, very tender story, and is really illustrative of I think, of Eliot's moral fiction, or fiction that she intended to have a moral effect, which was to enlarge our sympathies. And from there, I sort of devoured everything that she wrote, and it was a joy to reread everything in preparation for this small little book that I put out recently on George Eliot. But Middlemarch,
Absolutely.
yes, you're right. Yeah, Middlemarch was just a mammoth undertaking, and when I finally found my way through it, I kind of stopped and started and had other things that I had to do, but it was such a joy to read and such a joy to reread. And then it's been fun to read books about Middlemarch written by folk like Rebecca Mead, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker. She has a wonderful book called My Life in Middlemarch, where she just simply describes, you know, what has turned out to be a lifelong delight that she has taken in this novel, which we can talk about in a moment if you like. But yeah,
Sure.
Eliot is someone who's meant a great deal to me, partly because she was born in my part of the world. She was born really in the West Midlands. I was born in the East Midlands, and there's something of that sensibility that shows up in her fiction, something of the nonconformist impulse. Which, yeah, you're quite right. Explained why she kind of deconverted from traditional religion, such as it was back there in the 19th century, and moved into a kind of spirituality of sympathy, if you want to call it that. Again, we can talk about that as we move through.
What fascinates me about her, you know, in reading the variety of passages that you have, because you've mined not just the famous novels, but some of her other writings, was this sensibility, this mature sensibility that she has, you know. When you compare that to, say, Dickens, and Dickens is a fine writer, no doubt, but the sensibility's not quite there. She has a spiritual maturity that's quite ennobling, actually. And you know, as you say, her common theme is the idea of, you know, it's not good enough just to hold a religious view. It has to be put into practice, right? We have to care. And she talks a lot about the inequities between, you know, the ones who are rich and in power, and those that are dispossessed, and like as you referenced in Silas Marner, and you know that's very apropos today. You know, when we see the divisions between, you know, the 1% and the rest of us struggling, and just the polarities. It may have been written in the 19th century, but it's bang up to date. You know, it's extremely relevant today, isn't it?
I think you're right. Yeah, she does. She has an incredible kind of an enduring legacy. And of course, 2019 is an auspicious year for George Eliot aficionados and anyone who sort of dips into her work. You know, it marks the bicentenary of her birth. Born, as you rightly note, as Marianne Evans, and then but better known as George Eliot. Born there in Nuneaton in England on the 22nd of November, 1819. And, of course, there'll be lots of conferences and special events and commission books that will be scheduled to celebrate that auspicious literary anniversary. And I'd like to think that my book has a small or a modest place within that collection of books there. She does have an enduring legacy, I think, because there's something about her nonconformist impulse, the fact that she pushes back against the Christianity of her day, that she catches something of the Enlightenment spirit that you can trace all the way to someone like Hegel, the fact that she is... Well, frankly, she has a brain the size of a planet, and not one of those dwarf planets either. She has a striking intelligence that enables her to translate some of the great continental philosophical figures like David Friedrich Strauss and Ludwig Feuerbach and Benedict Spinoza. So she makes those thinkers available in English really for the first time. To 19th century Victorian readers who are going through their own crisis of faith and doubt. I sometimes picture as a kind of antecedent to this impulse that occurs in both Europe and in the United States towards the end of the 20th century, and that's what we've all come to know now as the kind of I'm spiritual but not religious impulse or movement. You know, so there's a sense in which that phrase is a little hackneyed now, a little tired maybe, and we're in search of a new one. But you know, when it first emerged, it was really an interesting phrase because it captured a kind of a late 20th century, early 21st century sense that religion in its organized or institutional form was corrupt, was or at least could display elements of corruption and hypocrisy, and you know, the sense that somehow the things to come in the next world are more important than the things in this world, and that love of God is more important than love of one's fellow human being. George Eliot would have had none of that. She would have you know, sort of really critiqued the idea that religion is about the afterlife or about you know, the happy hunting grounds that we go to after we die. She was very much, you know, sort of opposed to institutional and organized forms of religion, if that's what they made or inspired people to do. So she was, I think, spiritual but not religious in her own time. And I think folk who are that way inclined today and who pick up someone like George Eliot would find an ally in that struggle.
Right. What's fascinating to me, too, for those of us who are Unity people, and this is a Unity show, of course, is the resonances I found when reading the passages that you've chosen with Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, you know, the co-founders of Unity, because they talked about consciousness in much the same way that George Eliot talks about. And it's amazing to me, you know, you've got this very fine novelist, you know, a world novelist, and he's speaking the same language as you know, the founders of a particular movement that we're interested in, and it's almost confirmation. You know, the human spirit is it's connected, it's one. You know, the when you scratch beneath the surface of things, you find these unitive commonalities throughout everything. And it really speaks to, you know, practical Christianity, which is what Charles Fillmore called Unity. It was not something you do on Sunday, you know, but something as a way of life that you can do every single day. Let me read this quote you have from Eliot here. She says, "The only effect I ardently long to produce by my writings is that those who read them should be better able to imagine and to feel the pains and the joys of those who differ from themselves in everything but the broad fact of being struggling, erring human creatures. There's that commonality again. But you've Absolutely. Put in italics those two words, imagine and feel. You know, this is the compassionate heart, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. it's what the Buddha talks about. It's the bodhisattva, the suffering servant, you know, the Jesus is sometimes described that, to feel with someone, you know, to walk in their shoes and break down barriers. It's a radical stance because it calls us out of our comfort zones into not doing good, right? That's not what, it's not just the social gospel. It is seeing as another sees, right? Imagining right. what it might be like to be LGBT, for instance, you know, in our modern world, or what it means to be a woman, you know, facing retrenchment of ideas around abortion or whatever. So it's an invitation to not just be a demagogue about it, but how does it feel to be that person going through that experience? I think it's extremely right. salutary if we can do that.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, it's for Eliot, as for a great many novelists and creative writers and poets who came after her, it's imaginative writing or fiction, prose, poetry, a short story, the novel. Those are the genres which enable us to actually travel in the mind's eye and roam around a territory that's not our own, and then return to ourselves, maybe with enlarged sympathy for the folk that we meet, as it were, in our mind's eye, as we're traveling into those other worlds. Fiction has that remarkable, at least good fiction, has the remarkable ability to transport us into those other lives and to see the world through fresh eyes. And when we return to ourselves, when we actually, you know, finish the final page, as it were, of a novel, if we get there, and close the book and then return to ourselves, maybe it's a short leap, really, to sort of move from the other world represented and the other selves represented by the novel and its world to the world of our experience and the people around us, the you know, what Johnny Cash called the walking wounded, you know, the people who are hurting. Those individuals around us, we don't really know what goes on in the hidden chambers of the human heart, but to you know, encounter people with a desire for sympathy and a desire to realize that these folk are like, as well as Hank Williams called them, men with broken hearts or women with broken hearts, individuals with broken hearts, really. I get that from Eliot, that deep desire for sympathy. And the deep desire, just to go back to what you were saying about the founder of the Unity movement, the deep desire to sort of see and sense something of what Eliot called the mystery beneath the real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very, very aware, as many were in her part of the 19th century, that evolution, I mean, you know, some of her early writings are there just before Charles Darwin writes The Origin of Species and publishes it. She's very sensitive to evolution as the mechanism which drives, you know, the processes of reality, the experience that surrounds us. But she's not given to what you might call a scientism. She doesn't reduce all forms of knowing to scientific forms of knowing. She's not a reductionist in that respect. She thinks and senses that there's a mystery beneath the real, which I guess, you know, we recognize that different people in different cultures have different names for that mystery beneath the real, and therein lies the entry point into something like religious pluralism and learning how to coexist. So again, I think she has this enduring legacy. She speaks to us from across the centuries.
Of course, those of us in certain branches of spirituality today, you know, when we hear the term real, we put a capital R on it, and we're talking about the real as opposed to the unreal conditions of the illusory nature right. of life. But when she uses that term, she's talking about reality in its relative sense, right? So it's the mystery about beyond the circumstances and the dogmatic constructs we place on life. And so, you know, it depends on the terminology you're using here to penetrate into what she's saying. Mm. Interesting, you should say, you know, it's the commemoration year for George Eliot's, also John Ruskin's commemoration, right, this year. There's a lot of things going on around him. And I know, mm-hmm, she wrote a review of modern painters, I think, which I was interested to read about in my studies, you know, getting ready for the show. So again, correlations there. And he was a great social reformer as well. A fascinating guy. I was in London recently and went to the Astor House where John Astor built a fantastic ornate house there in Blackfriars on the Thames, and it's now a Ruskin Museum. And it was fascinating to see. I knew a little bit about Ruskin from college, but I always saw him as kind of a dry man. But it's the opposite. He was a firebrand, wasn't he? He was amazing, and he could liven up audiences like you wouldn't believe. You know, he would go to, right, and he set up all these institutes and whatnot. So remarkable life, also. So two great exemplars, really, of progressive thinking in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And just like Eliot, someone who, in a way, deconverted from traditional or mainstream or mainline Christianity during his time, you know, but then kind of reconverted or found something else. Didn't see this deconversion as a negative thing, but as laying the groundwork for something else that would come after it. So really interesting thinking. Yeah.
There's a beautiful passage here on page 26, if you don't mind me reading it. This is, sure, from the epilogue to Mr. Gilfil's love story, and it says, "But it is with men as with trees. If you lop off their finest branches into which they were pouring their young life juice, the wounds will be healed over with some rough boss, some odd excrescence. And what might have been a grand tree expanded into liberal shade," that's quite a line, "is but a whimsical misshapen trunk. Many an irritating fault, many an unlovely oddity has come of a hard sorrow, which has crushed and maimed the nature just when it was expanding into plenteous beauty. And the trivial erring life which we visit with our harsh blame may be but as the unsteady motion of a man whose best limb is withered." And the number one, the beauty of the writing, the poetry, is just, mm-hmm, blows your socks off, doesn't it?
But it does.
You know, we've all suffered in our lives. We've all had limbs chopped off, not literally, but harsh words that have been said to us, maybe by our parents or by somebody, mm-hmm, in school or whatever it is. And we were growing, and then we've withered, and we turned into this unlovely creature here, this unlovely oddity. What a great line, though. What might have been a grand tree expanding into liberal shade. Oh, my goodness. Mm. And if you can't feel empathy towards that, what can you feel, right?
Right, right. And it's interesting how she draws your attention to you know, a self, an individual, but then sort of has you kind of expand outwards to something else. So she's moving from what you might call self-centeredness to heightened consideration of others. And she's, through the prose, is actually bringing you into that kind of field of force. And I do think it is a field of force. Those who read her, those who reflect on her, see all of this, and then they find themselves invited, drawn into it. And the quote that you gave a little earlier about the effect that she hoped her fiction would have on others, that's certainly been the effect that it's had on me and on many, many individuals, folk like yourself, who've read Eliot and found themselves sort of just drawn into what she has to say and what she would have you do once you're finished reading. That's the interesting thing.
Right, exactly. And so not to be taken in by, you know, what appears to be on the surface of things or how people show up in their presentation, rather see into the heart here, what's really going on. You know, there's a great quote that's probably been overquoted. It says, "Be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a great battle." And that's been attributed to many great people. But it's a wonderful quote, isn't it? Because it's true. You know, every one of us is struggling with our own inner demons, you know, our own attempt to be alive, you know, attempt to be human, fully human in this incarnation is not always easy. So I have empathy in that regard. Of course, in unity, we would say, you know, just as the Bible said, you know, a shoot will rise up from the stump of Jesse, right? You know, there's always new life, even though things have been cut down. You know, as long as you're alive, there's always new possibility. There's always new possibility shooting forth.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the wonderful things that I enjoy about reading Eliot is that she focuses on these ordinary folk, individuals like ourselves who are walking wounded, who do have broken hearts. And then what she does, she takes you into the ordinariness of their lives and shows how that ordinariness kind of opens out to its own form of extraordinariness. And that's something magical. There's a strange alchemy that her fiction works on, you know, the right kind of reader, where it just kind of works its own magic, and you're able to see your own ordinariness as opening out to some kind of extraordinariness as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, you would say that her writing, even though it's not, it's unflinching, and it's a willingness to look at difficulty and sorrow and suffering, you know, is ultimately optimistic, isn't it? It's a yeah. vision that is a redemptive thing, you know, that you feel enhanced after reading her writings, you know, as opposed to oh my God, life is terrible, I think I'm going to commit suicide. You know, it's not right. like that. Right. She had an unwavering faith, even though she wasn't traditionally Christian. You know, she was deeply spiritual. I would say.
Deeply, and I think she's a lot of the ethics of reading Eliot, or what she wants you to get out of reading her in terms of ethics, has a great deal in common with actually traditional Christianity, ironically enough, because
right.
you find yourself by losing yourself in a sense.
There we go.
And that's
there's the music starting up. We're losing this segment, folks. We gotta go to the break, but guess what? We'll be back. Join us in a couple of minutes.
We're glad you found us. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio. This programming is made possible through the generous donations of listeners like you. If you feel inspired by this programming, we invite you to contribute. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate to make your offering today. Thank you for your support.
Here is a Unity Meditation Minute with Paulette Pipe.
So as always, we begin our time of meditation by first taking account of what we're feeling, those sights that we're seeing, those sensations that we're experiencing, and each breath that we breathe. Notice where in your body you're experiencing those sensations. Let your breathing find its own rhythm as we begin the process of letting go, the process of relaxation. Remember why we're here.
To hear more from Paulette Pipe and Touching the Stillness, visit the archives section at unityonlineradio.org.
Ah, Italy. The food, the wine, the art, the culture. Join friends from Unity on a trip to Italy in the spring of 2020. In Rome, you'll walk in the footsteps of the Apostle Paul, visit the Colosseum and the Roman Forum, then head down the beautiful Amalfi Coast to Sorrento, the Isle of Capri, and the ruins of Pompeii, all with people you feel as if you already know. For more, visit unity.org/travel.
Know yourself as divine, Stations of the Cosmic Christ, a new book from Matthew Fox and Bishop Mark Andrus, introduce a spiritual practice designed to help you realize the divine within. Combining prayer and an interpretation of the Stations of the Cross, featuring beautiful imagery, you will be led on a process of transformation. This book will help you discover the most caring, courageous, and compassionate parts of yourself. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or unity.org/shop.
Tune into Everyday Attraction with Ray Zander every Friday at 12 p.m. Central here on Unity Online Radio. Take a deep dive into the teachings of Abraham and discover how to make the law of attraction work for you in your life. Each week, Ray goes into the heart of understanding the power of our emotions and how to become conscious co-creators. Learn how to release resistant thoughts and live life to the fullest. Find out more at everydayattraction.com.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Darren Middleton. We're talking about a book that he's published in the Literary Portals to Prayer series. This is 50 passages from George Eliot's short passages, and then contrasting scriptures from the Message edition of the Bible. And we're looking at some of these passages, looking at some of George Eliot's key themes. One of the key things is she was never didactic, right? She presented various aspects and allowed you to see the nuances between each one. And I love that about her. And sometimes we referenced Dickens earlier, and sometimes he does get a little bit didactic, and he's got a program here. But you don't find that with Eliot. Darren, would you like to read page 30, Everything Works Together? Because I think that's a good example of allowing, you know, contrasting viewpoints to rest together.
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. This is from The Mill on the Floss, Book 5, Chapter 1. I've pieced it with Philippians Chapter 4, verses 8 through 9, with the theme Everything Works Together. Philip turned to walk on as if he had not patience to stand still any longer, and they went out of the hollow, winding amongst the trees and bushes in silence. After that last word of Philip's, Maggie could not bear to insist immediately on their parting. "I've been a great deal happier," she said at last, timidly, "since I have given up thinking about what is easy and pleasant, and being discontented because I couldn't have my own will. Our life is determined for us, and it makes the mind very free when we give up wishing and only think of bearing what is laid upon us and doing what is given us to do." "But I can't give up wishing," said Philip impatiently. "It seems to me we can never give up longing and wishing while we are thoroughly alive. There are certain things we feel to be beautiful and good, and we must hunger after them. How can we ever be satisfied without them until our feelings are deadened?"
And so we get two contrasting viewpoints there, don't we? Which are both valid, right? You know, and it's the same as
right.
predestination and free will, you know, quietism or social action or whatever, you know, which is right? Well, yes, I guess they're both right, aren't they? There's time for surrender and release, but then, you know, we still have to act. We still have to chop wood and carry water. So they're both right in their own way, yeah?
Absolutely. And there she's kind of pushing back against the Calvinistic evangelicalism of her youth, and yet she recognizes its validity in a sense as an overlay, or at least the way it shapes some people's thinking. So she leaves it to the reader to decide, as I think a good novelist probably should, which one of these overlays you're going to instantiate in your own life, if at all. So,
well, and then in the Philippians, it's a nice tie-in. If you want to read that too, because it ties the both together.
Sure, and you know, this just to remind listeners that you know, Philip is saying that there are certain things we feel to be beautiful and good, and we must hunger after them. As I thought about Philip's words there, I sort of thought about the Apostle Paul's words in Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 through 9. So here's the message version of that chapter and verse. Summing it all up, friends, I'd say you'll do best by filling your minds and meditating on things true, noble, reputable, authentic, compelling, gracious, the best, not the worst, the beautiful, not the ugly, things to praise, not things to curse. Put into practice what you learned from me, what you heard and saw and realized. Do that, and God, who makes everything work together, will work you into his most excellent harmonies.
Yes.
So again, that whole idea of meditating on you know, on the transcendentals, really, on truth, beauty, and goodness. There's something in the Christian intellectual tradition and moral tradition that makes those things very valuable to ponder and think on. And, you know, stretching all the way back to the Apostle Paul, but coming forward in time through not just the great theologians, but the great novelists as well, like George Eliot, you know, asking us to think about and then obviously to put into practice truth, beauty, and goodness in our own lives.
Right, and so much here, isn't there? Because it's the idea you do what you can and then you release and let go, right? There's always that willingness to enter the mystery beyond the relative reality of what's going on at any given time, you know, surrender to that. But not without the work, though, you know, so there's a nice balance there. I think what it's saying also is a bit like Mary and Martha, you know. One was fretting about everything, one was sitting quietly listening to Jesus, and Jesus said, you know, Mary's done the better part, she's calm, she's listening, and, you know, all the work in the world isn't going to get us there. You know, there's times when, yeah, we do the work, but we have to stop and listen and open ourselves. So, you know, delicate balance, if you like, sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I think something of the various thinkers that she's reading and in some cases translating from German into English, a lot of those thinkers are affecting the way she thinks religiously and theologically. I think she does yearn for a kind of earthbound spirituality, a kind of an active prayer. She wants to see herself as the answer to her own prayers. She wants to see she wants other people to see themselves as answers to their own prayers, which is why I'm you know, pleased that this book comes out in a series that that my publisher ACTA Publications put out called Literary Portals to Prayer. There are 10 or 11 in that series now, with some famous writers who are paired with the Bible. Everyone from Louisa May Alcott to Jane Austen, Dickens, whom you mentioned, and then Elizabeth Gaskell and Shakespeare, Wharton and Whitman. These are all you know, writers who I think wanted a kind of earthbound spirituality, something that a way of looking at the world that helped us help the world and help the world to become better than what it is in any given moment. And I think her fiction invites you into that that challenge, really, to make the world a better place and to move away from a kind of trans-historical spirituality, where you're always looking to what I guess Dietrich Bonhoeffer would call the ultimate things. You should be focused on the penultimate things, this life, the only life that we are absolutely certain about, I think Eliot would say. So, and I think, you know, in the back of her mind here is, you know, writers like Feuerbach, whom she translated, of course. Feuerbach famously, you know, the great Hegelian thinker, puts out his book, The Essence of Christianity, in 1841. Eliot translates it in 1854, makes it available in an English version. And of course, what is Feuerbach doing there? He's, you know, like many people in the Victorian era, He's very critical of traditional Christianity. He doesn't see the essence of Christianity lying in sort of life after death, or, you know, a post-conscious existence after bodily, or, a, you know, I should say a continued conscious existence after bodily death. He doesn't see that. He, you know, theology for him is a form of anthropology. It's a, if you examine God talk, then you'll learn a great deal about what it actually means to be human. For Feuerbach, religion's kind of sociologically, culturally, psychologically conditioned. And in that sense, you know, he thinks religion is rooted in a kind of dependence, you know, where we are very aware of ourselves in an impersonal kind of alien universe, what Carl Sagan called the, you know, the pale blue dot, right? You know, once you realize that we're in this vast, vast universe, you know, it can leave you feeling very afraid. And so you start whistling in the dark, and religion is a kind of whistling in the dark for someone like Feuerbach. Meaning is not inherent. We actually end up making it. For Feuerbach, it's psychologically damaging to sort of think of ourselves as being dependent upon an imagined God. So what Feuerbach favored in that book, The Essence of Christianity, was a love of people for each other, not necessarily the love of a transhistorical supernatural agent that we happen to call God. He wanted folk to have faith in themselves and not necessarily belief in an imagined or a projected God. And he wanted people to engage this world and not pine for the next. And Feuerbach, of course, was very influential on someone like Karl Marx, who famously, of course, it's an oft-quoted phrase, religion is the opiate of the people. You know, it kind of is like a drug that dulls people's sensibilities to the inequalities and the rigors of life around them, promises a corrective of everything that's wrong in this life and the next. Marx wasn't happy with religion thus defined, and neither was Feuerbach, and neither was Eliot. And, you know, there's a small piece of trivia. George Eliot is actually buried just a few yards away from Karl Marx in Highgate Cemetery.
That's so, right.
You know,
yeah.
they shared a sensibility, but they also share common ground now in a way.
Yeah, yeah. She wasn't allowed to be in the hallowed place, was she, because of her radical nature of her life, I guess. But then I did read that she, there's a little stone now in Westminster Abbey with her name on it in the Poets' Corner, well, you know, in the literary area of the Abbey there. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Almost harbingers of existentialism, right? Early forms of. Mm-hmm. Existential thinking. I know that she didn't like maxims, and she could sum up that by saying she didn't like easy answers, right? And there's a wonderful quote from Middlemarch. It says, this is in the "No grass will grow under your feet, but I have a belief of my own and it comforts me." "What is that?" Mm-hmm. said Will, rather jealous of the belief. "That is, by desiring what is perfectly good, even when we don't quite know what it is and cannot do what we would, we are part of the divine power against evil, widening the skirts of light and making the struggle with darkness narrower." That is a beautiful mysticism. It is a, "Please do not call it by any name," said Dorothea, putting out her hands entreatingly. "You will say it is Persian or something else geographical. It is my life. I have found it out, and I cannot part with it. I've always been finding out my religion since I was a little girl." And really, you know, she's standing in there for George Eliot herself in some ways, isn't she? But isn't that beautiful? You know, don't call it mysticism. Don't label it. Because once you've labeled something, you can no longer see it, you know, for what it is in its original direct experience, right? It's always, we put it away in a box. You know, it's Persian or whatever. It's not geographical. Sounds like Jesus, low here, low there. The kingdom of God does not come with observation, right? The kingdom of heaven is within you. But I love that. "It is my life. I have found it out and cannot part with it." I have found it out. It's no longer an idea that I have in my head. I have found it right. To be real, to be true inside my heart, right? So there can't be any greater spirituality than that.
Right. She's very, Dorothea is very aware there of the the heresy of reduction, or the heresy of paraphrase, or the heresy of giving it a label, frankly.
Yeah,
you can call it Persian. You could also actually call it Augustinian, I guess, in the sense that, you know, she's pushing back against the idea that the self finds itself by sort of gazing inward. Augustine's whole notion of sin as incurvatus in se, the curving in on oneself. If Eliot's fiction is about anything, and I think if Dorothea's life is about anything, it's about actually looking outward, not inward, and seeking a kind of an everyday mysticism finds the truth of faith in service of others, not in, you know, curving in on oneself. But look at me, I'm applying labels to what is, you're quite right, a direct experience. And she wouldn't
well,
want
you know,
me to do
occupational
that.
Hazards,
I'm going to back
yeah.
off.
Yeah, you know, those who speak do not know; those that know do not speak. But you know, in the middle of that, you have to speak. And even the great sage spoke, you know, or wrote down those lines. So you know, there's the conundrum of our lives, right? But I do like what you said earlier, you know, because about you know, it being a very present reality, because Jesus said the very same thing, you know, when they were asking him what's going to happen after we die, and you know, who's going to be, you know, who, what's the hierarchy, and he said, you know, let the dead bury the dead, you know, God is God, not of the dead, but of the living, and you know, the Buddha didn't like these abstruse points either. He would always, you know, counsel against people asking questions about esoteric ideas or what happens after your death, you know, work out your own salvation with diligence here and now, you know, in the present mm-hmm. moment. That's all we really have. It's all we really know. Yeah, everything else is supposition.
Right. And you know, some of Eliot's really interesting writings, I mean, everything she wrote is really interesting, but some of the stuff that really stands out to me is the stuff that she has to say in her essays, where she's pushing back against the evangelical preachers of her own day, who seem to be obsessed, the way a lot of people were in the 19th century, with figuring out the day and the hour and the minute when Jesus is going to come back again soon. She does not have any truck with that. She's not interested, and she thinks that the essence of Christianity lies elsewhere. It's not in some kind of apocalyptic second coming, but is actually in the service of others and in the heightened consideration of others, particularly those who are the least of these, right? So there's a really solid New Testament ethic for someone who's allegedly deconverted and then abandoned religion completely. I'm not convinced. I think something of the New Testament sort of ethics, particularly the ethics of kenosis, you know, of emptying yourself of self-regard. And taking on a kind of heightened consideration of others, if that's the essence of Christianity, and I guess it's debatable, but I'd like to think that it is. If that's the essence of Christianity, then Eliot's fiction has that on practically every page.
Right, absolutely. We've got so many to cover here. I've got three that I really love. One's page 92 from Daniel Deronda. That's a great one. One's on page 102 from Middlemarch. And then I love the one from Felix Holt on that 106. Which is your favorite out of those? Putting you on the line. Just choose one and read it. And we'll... decide between those three. But which one intuitively speaks to you today?
Of those three or of the ones that
yeah,
I have in the book?
Yeah, of those three.
Because I have to sort of be honest and sort of say that my favorite is the last one, which is from
the
finale.
Let's do that, because
March.
I think we only got enough time for one. You read it for us?
It's a long quote, but I'll take the final paragraph. It's really Eliot's narrator. Eliot's narrator is looking back on Dorothea, who, of course, is the protagonist in the story. And Dorothea has died, and you know, the narrator is reflecting on that. And it says this, her finely touched spirit had still its fine issues, though they were not widely visible. Her full nature, like that river of which Cyrus broke the strength, spent itself in channels which had no great name on the earth. But the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive, for the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs.
Wow.
That's just a beautiful passage that just sort of takes ordinary human beings and sort of said, that's how the world evolves. The growing good of the world is partly dependent upon unhistoric acts. That's just the ordinariness of individuals making a difference where they are. If that's not spirituality, leave aside, you know, the kind of abstract reflection on the doctrine of the Trinity, that seems not to interest Eliot at whatsoever. She's much more interested in helping ordinary people realize that their ordinary attempts to struggle, the mistakes that they made, but also the accomplishments they achieve, that those are all largely unhistoric acts, but they make the world develop and change and evolve. And most of us, our fate is to lie or rest in unvisited tombs. People will forget us, but the world won't, in a way. And maybe God, in God's own time, in or out of time, won't forget us either. That's our hope.
We're so in love with the great and the good and with celebrity and, you know, with all that razzmatazz, aren't we? And so often it's really not what it seems to be anyway, you know. It doesn't bring happiness. It doesn't bring true clarity often. It's just people thrust into the limelight, you know, who are not the nicest people. But, you know, some of the greatest people I've known in my life have been those people we're just discussing, you know, that living humble lives, but filled with spirit and making a difference. And to me, that's is a beautifully ennobling passage, you know, for us all, right? And and it fits in. We got room for one more, so I'm going to fit in the General Gironda here, because it's sort of similar. In the checkered area of human experience, the seasons are all mingled, as in the golden age. Fruit and blossom hang together. In the same moment, the sickle is reaping and the seed is sprinkled. One tends the green cluster and another treads the winepress. Nay, in each of our lives, harvest and springtime are continually one, until death himself gathers us and sows us anew in his invisible fields. Again, beautiful poetry there. She was a great poet as well as a great novelist. But you know, that mingling there, you know, it's not a sequential thing. It's not, well, I did that, so I should be rewarded. No, it's all happening at once, right? Just as I'm celebrating, you know, the birth of a new grandchild here for me, you know, another person is passing. You know, the spring is here, but in another part of the world, it's fall or whatever. And intermingled in our own consciousness, you know, there's old gnarled ideas, and then there's fresh spring ideas happening in our consciousness, and they're all relevant, right? I think that's the message, is that, you know, there's time for cynicism and there's time for hopeless optimism, you know, all at once in our journey in this life. So it's an embracing viewpoint. Of course, that novel is about you know, a lot of Jewish issues, right? And again, the embrace of the one that is different from us. Again, very, very apropos in our modern world, where we reject people who are different from us, you know, and castigate them in some way. So,
And where people struggle,
I'm excited. I'm excited.
That life is
firing me up,
Darren. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Thank you for creating this wonderful collection. You know, it is a bit like Lectio Divina for me, you know, where you just take a passage and you find a few lines within that passage that really resonate with you, and you take it down deep in contemplation. And I find this works very well with Eliot, that you could take some of the lines and they just speak to you directly, and move you at a level beyond your intellect, right? They move you at an intuitive level, and you can use this book for that purpose. And hence the name, Literary Portals to Prayer, that deeper prayer where we're connecting to the numinous, to the real with a capital R. We've got a minute left. What would you like to impart to our community in a final statement, Darren?
I hope that the book is helpful to folk for their spiritual development, for their theological education, for hopefully the big prize would be to lead people back to Eliot's novels in their entirety, so that the reader can find themselves being drawn out of themselves and into a completely fascinating world, and then back into the so-called real world of the reader, where they can hopefully begin to cultivate some sympathy and some understanding for difference around them. Without difference, where would we be with desire? That would be my thought. I think that's...
Oh, that's an interesting line, isn't it? Say it again.
Yeah.
Without difference.
Without difference, where would we be with desire?
Uh-huh. There's all kinds of resonances there, from, you know, very profound to the sexual to the... companionable, you know, there's all kinds of meanings to that, isn't there? Yeah.
Sure,
so
absolutely.
In other words, embrace the difference here, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, it certainly inspired me. I dug out my old Middlemarch from 1972 that I bought in college, and it's pretty brown right now, but I'm ready to read the 885 pages. We referenced it was a long book at the beginning of the show, and it is a long book, but again, it's lovely reading, so you can pass happy hours reading that. So if this has inspired you to go back to George Eliot or to discover her for the first time, that's wonderful. And if not, just get the book. It's very palatable, short passages called George Eliot, Illuminated by the Message, Darren Middleton. It's published, and it'll be available in all the usual outlets. If people want to get a hold of you, Darren, what's the best way?
Best way would be to go to the Texas Christian University Department of Religion website. You'll find my picture and my profile, and that will lead you to my email or to my telephone number. That's the best way.
Awesome. Next week, we're going to shift subjects and talk about cannabis as in spiritual practice with Will Johnson. He's the director of the Institute of Embodiment Training in Costa Rica. So that'll be interesting. Join us then. Have a great week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.